Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the April 26th Forum, featuring Mayo Clinic President and CEO, Dr. John Noseworthy. I'm Warren Zola. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Dr. Noseworthy engaged in a fireside chat with Mike Mahoney, Chairman and CEO of Boston Scientific Corporation. The conversation touched on a variety of subjects, including the future of healthcare, Mayo's use of a team-based approach to medicine, the importance of engineers, and his pending retirement. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club.
So it's an honor for us to host you here. Just frame it for about a minute, then we look forward to a fun dialogue with the team here. I think Warren said it, healthcare is an incredibly hot topic. It's very personable to everybody. It's in the news. There's incredible innovation that Warren talked about in Rochester as well as Boston here. A lot of discussion on cost of healthcare. 18% of our GDP is in healthcare. And it's also in the news every day on Affordable Care Act as well as all the mergers and acquisitions. So it's such a great topic. And we're blessed to have you here as such an incredible institution. But before we start, Dr. Noseworthy, he asked me to call him John, a neurologist, is throwing out the first pitch Saturday, which is quite an honor. So we'd love to hear a little bit about that and your Boston roots before we get going.
Thanks very much. I'm going to try to throw the first pitch out. I hope I don't bounce it, but I probably will. Mike, it's great to be here, and thank you all for this opportunity. My family's Canadian. My dad was an Episcopal Anglican minister and sent by the Bishop of Montreal to the Diocese of Massachusetts. I was born in Melrose, lived in Saugus, and then moved to Wayland. Went to St. Mark's School and then in Southborough, and then we moved back to Canada. My kids came here for some of their education, and I did a postdoc in Boston. So this is very dear to our hearts. I just met a third cousin four times removed, John Hawthorne, and we're definitely related. There's no doubt about it, given the little story we just had. And I played hockey against Jay Hooley's father. I think it was his father. It certainly wasn't Jay, but anyway, so it's great to be back, really great to be back in Boston.
You played them for homecoming to get the easy win, Hooley's family?
Hooley's family, but anyway.
Thank you for that.
It's good to be
welcome
here.
Back here. Just want to talk a little bit about the incredible hospital system you have,
yep.
The history that you have. And the values that represent the Mayo system. So maybe you could give us a little bit of insight into
sure.
the history of the of how it's grown, and more importantly, the values and how you maintain that.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. So as we heard, Mayo Clinic's 150-something years old, dates back to Dr. William Worrell Mayo, who was commissioned by Abraham Lincoln, President Clinton, to examine the Union soldiers. I tell that story in this part of the world, not south of the Mason-Dixon line, but... and then he had two sons, Will and Charlie, who became prominent surgeons. In 1883, a tornado ripped through Rochester, destroyed the town, and with the Sisters of St. Francis, these men of science put together a hospital and basically founded the Mayo Clinic. Now, to talk about healthcare in Boston seems a bit redundant because you have the finest institutions in the world here, as you all know. And we're very grateful for that and honor the healthcare in Massachusetts and New England. Mayo was set up a little bit differently, as you heard. It is really the first integrated group practice of medicine, which basically what it meant was it's a partnership. And that partnership has survived 150 years. And the partners are salaried physicians who are recruited with a focus on taking care of patients as a team. 110 years ago, they decided there should be a unified medical record. So if you go back well over 100 years, a patient at Mayo Clinic, and I met several of you whose moms and grandparents and so on were there, there would be a medical record with their number on it. And that medical record would go from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor So it was a transparent healthcare system, so we could see whether the doctors, as partners, were good at diagnosis, good at procedures, and so on. So very open system, and that helped us provide team-based care. And that's really stuck with us. They also invested heavily in education and research, and that's been embedded in the Mayo model. And I guess the probably the most unsung secret sauce at Mayo were the engineers. And I know there are some engineers in the room, but for well over 100 years, engineers have been part of the medical team. We have 200 management engineers right now in the practice who help us drive efficiency, drive safety, better outcomes. And if you want to get those problems solved, don't ask a doctor, ask an engineer. And I don't know any other place that's done that. I've told that to all sorts of healthcare systems in this country, in Europe, in England. And people just look, well, doctors don't like to work with engineers or whatever, or engineers probably don't want to work with doctors, I don't know. But it's that's why it's worked out so well. We're, the Franciscan and our founders' values are very important to us. And so any question that comes up at the Mayo Clinic, either in the administrative side or in the practice, we find if we just put the patient at the center of the room, center of the table, and say, what's best for this patient, we always get the answer more quickly. So that's it's just a privilege to work there. I've been there 30 years and have loved every day. But it's just it's a different system from the systems we have in Boston and New York and San Francisco and so on.
Yeah, great. Well, it's definitely not your everyday.
And I'll put a plug in, I guess. Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker, has just completed a 2-hour documentary on the Mayo Clinic, and we're pleased that it'll be shown on PBS nationally 2 consecutive days in September, which really tells the story of the Mayo Clinic as an American institution evolving over 150 years. So we're actually quite pleased about that.
Yeah, great. Just a question, because you're competing on a global scale with the reputation of your hospital system. And just recently, we had an employee in India who needed open heart surgery. And right away, they think Brigham and Women's, Mass General, Mayo, UPMC, Cleveland Clinic. So really competing at a different level globally. So when you think about how you help differentiate Mayo from other big, great institutions on quality and quality metrics, how do you go about doing that?
Well, Mike, you know, are we competitive with other groups? I think that's true. But essentially, if you work at Mayo, you're there for the patient. And I know that sounds kind of sanctimonious. And the first time I heard it, I remember calling my wife and saying, don't worry, honey, nothing's going to happen. I'm not going to move here. But in the back of my mind, everyone told me, yeah, right, so she hasn't believed me since then. But what I found is that, and again, it's just the culture is so strong at Mayo, that everyone is there for that single purpose, whether they're scientists or engineers or physicians or pharmacists or whatever. And it's just the way it, and if it doesn't work for you, you wouldn't be there. So someone said the other day, gee, you answer your pagers. Mm. Well, yeah, there might be a patient on the other end or a doctor or whatever. So it's just you buy into that. And I think the team-based focus on the patient helps us get, and the other thing with the engineers, we realize, wait a second, if people are coming from 140 countries, or if they're coming from Manhattan or LA or Tennessee or wherever it is, they don't really want to spend a whole lot of time in Rochester, Minnesota. I mean, it's not a bad place and we like it, but they've come for that one thing. And so pre-scheduling tests, by the end of the first day, essentially getting 2, 3, 4 teams to look at that patient, works for us, it gets the answer more quickly, and we think more accurately. And that's a differentiator, because again, I would never want to compete with Man's Greatest Hospital down the street, and Torch and the rest of it. I mean, it's just my son and daughter-in-law trained there and are proud of it, and I trained there, did some of my training there, very proud of it. It's just engineered differently. It's just set up differently. I mean, Rochester has a population of 110,000 people now, so it's really grown. But, you know, 40,000 of them or 30,000 of them work at the Mayo Clinic. So it's there for that purpose. Mm. So it's just very different.
So there's so much going on in the healthcare industry and various trends with hospital consolidations, acquisitions, innovation, technology, cost. So when you think about some of the larger sweeping trends that you see in the healthcare industry going forward, what excites you the most or what do you think about?
Well, healthcare is on everyone's mind. I would say more now than it's ever been in my career, and I would say more now than it was even 5 or 8 years ago when the Affordable Care Act came out and so on. And I think there's an urgency now across the kitchen tables of America. I think people are really aware of it. a lot of folks are concerned about it because the costs are so high and rising, and it's with folks having very little discretionary money at this time, and a lot of self-employed people who can't get health care and so on. It's a big deal right now in our country, globally, of course, but we're talking about America. So it's important. The problem is it's contributing, it's the major contributor to the national debt. The rising cost of health care now, over 18% and heading towards 20. And so what we know has to happen is Americans deserve to have the highest quality possible of health care, safe, efficiently delivered, and with cutting edge care, and yet it's way too expensive. Mm-hmm. So all the efforts that you see at the great institutions like you have it here in Boston, and device companies and the life science companies, pharmaceutical companies, and the disruptive other companies that are getting into healthcare, is to deliver on this. How do you deliver it more efficiently, more safely, more consumer focused, more accurately, at lower cost? Mm-hmm. And so it's an extraordinarily disruptive time, but a very exciting time. And at the end of it all, just like Churchill said, we'll probably get it right. Mm-hmm. But no one's really quite sure how that's going to all come together. So there's a tremendous amount of consolidation across sectors, within the healthcare sectors, and a push for transparency, for consumerism, and for innovation. And this room's full of innovators. What a great time to be in healthcare. Yep. So there's a lot going on. As Warren mentioned, the pace of scientific discovery, and more importantly, getting that scientific discovery into the practice of medicine, in our case, has never been faster. But again, that all contributes to the cost, and how's this all going to play out? There's a chance that we'll cure Alzheimer's disease in our lifetime. We absolutely desperately need to, or else we're going to be in big, big trouble, as you know. The advances in cancer now are unbelievable. I was talking to Dr. Gilcher just a few minutes ago from Dana-Farber. She's excited about what's happening with cancer. We all are. So, but how's it all going to work? So stay tuned.
But you mentioned a few areas, and the breakthroughs have been incredible, cancer and cardiovascular and some neuro disorders. But when you think of some of these big epidemics, the opioid epidemic, Alzheimer's, anything you want to talk about in terms of what you're doing at the clinic to address some of these opportunities?
Well, Mayo's heavily invested, as you would expect, in the illnesses that cause either serious problems, and cancer would be one of those, Alzheimer's would be another, or complex problems. And what we mean by complex is a puzzle. No one can figure out what's wrong with this particular patient. And again, across those interfaces of cancer, neuroscience, transplantation, immunology, aging, and so on, we invest more than $1 billion a year in research and education to move that forward. The field of regenerative medicine. A couple of us were talking about our knees a minute ago, and it's turned. I'd like to wait for regenerative medicine to fix my knees, but I was told yesterday I can't wait that long. So, but it's, for some of you, it'll be coming. There's just a lot happening. All those areas are very, very exciting. The Alzheimer's field, as a neurologist, has basically come to realize that we're on the wrong path. Now, I'm not an Alzheimer's researcher, but there are well over 100 enormous and expensive clinical trials of promising therapies that work in experimental models, in animal models, in Alzheimer's disease, and they don't help patients. Mm. And 100 negative trials in Alzheimer's disease. So presumably, the hypothesis that we've been following is wrong. Or at least it's not fully accurate and right. And so we're going back to look at neural networks and how they interact and how they advance aging and so on. So it's kind of a drawback. Cancer, on the other hand, and I'm not a cancer expert. I'll just say I am a director at Merck, just to clear the record. So I understand the work they're doing there, and Mayo does a lot of work in cancer. But the diagnostics, the predictive analytics, genomics to understand who's going to have cancer, and now turning cancer into a chronic disease, which is our ultimate goal, ultimately prevention, of course, but it's a reality now. And there are now dozens of cancers that we can put in remission. And if you look at President Jimmy Carter, for heaven's sakes, he had metastatic brain cancer from a skin malignancy, and he's well. I mean, that never happened in my career, my 35 years in medicine, that patients with metastatic melanoma, sometimes now other metastatic diseases, can be put into prolonged remission. So it's a very exciting time. These medicines are expensive. The CAR T therapies, which were pioneered in Pennsylvania, and we're using them in Boston and at Mayo Clinic, they can cost upwards of $475,000 per patient. Well, where does that all come from? Yeah. That's an economic question. It's a socioeconomic question. It's what does the public want? And the public's going to have to come up with an answer to that. But as Warren said, the pace of change, diagnostics and predictive medicine and treatment is really accelerating. And America, to be honest, should be at the forefront of that. We should be leading this. We are the most innovative country in the biomedical sciences. We always have been. And that's why the continued investment in research at the NIH and the Department of Defense and everywhere else is such a mandate for all of us who've committed our lives to science and research. And the NIH, in spite of all odds and all the things that were said, did get a bump this year of $2.5 or $3 billion to keep it going. And that's absolutely crucial. It's not just it's good for humanity and the world needs it, it's really good for our economy. Right. I mean, it's the largest growing sector in terms of employment in the country is in health sciences. And these are good jobs yeah. that we would like our kids and nephews and nieces to have. So again, thank you for all you do to drive that economy forward as business leaders and support discovery science. It's the future.
Yeah, well, I think this room certainly shares that discovery. Well, the biotech companies here and med tech companies and the innovation you're talking about, it's really...
Well, maybe, I mean, can I just switch for a second? Because
Jay said, I just had to ask.
Well, I mean, you've come into Boston Scientific and have grown the revenues and grown the reach of Boston Scientific, as we heard from Warren. Maybe you just want to amplify a little bit of what I said because you lead a great company.
It's a similar, although different business. Everyone at BSC, and we have a table of them, first of all, they're actually very motivated with patients. And you have to love what you do and bring that spirit of discovery and helping patients to work, because when you do that, you give it a bit more extra effort. And so I think we've done a good job of culturally of aligning our engineers and our team to patient care and discovery and innovation, and not just on the financial numbers and so forth. So I think that's most important, because then you take a bit more risk and you innovate a bit more. And then it's been about a lot of things that you talked about is on portfolio innovation. And now you can put in aortic valves and the patients in the hospital for one day before they used to do a two-week surgery. We just received a product approval yesterday for Parkinson's disease and stimulate the brain to help with movement disorders. So for us, it's aligning our vision and engaging our employees and investing in disruptive capabilities to help grow the company.
Well, congratulations on that. That's fabulous. It's also a great example when we were talking about consolidation and consumerism and so on. I think what you all know, if you're not in healthcare, I'll just mention, it really does take partnerships. In order for this to happen, there's only so much that physicians and scientists can do, or device companies or pharma companies can do, unless they're all working together. And so Mayo partners with you. We have an accelerator in Minneapolis, one in Rochester to accelerate this further. My cousin and I are going to talk about getting an accelerator of Mayo here in Boston, so there you go. But it's that kind of partnerships that really are going to move us more quickly yep. forward. And it's good for business, but it's great for patients.
Can I ask you about innovation on the care delivery side? So a lot of it, you discussed a number of new opportunities on the technology side. But in terms of patient care delivery, where do you see that moving, and what trends and innovation can you bring to the patient care side?
Well, one great example of technology would be all the telemedicine, tele-ICU, tele-neonatology, and I didn't speak a lot about the opiate crisis in America, but tele-behavioral health, how we connect with patients in rural America and in inner cities using technology to keep close to them. That's important for our veterans. It's important for all Americans. That would be one area. Regulation, the regulatory environment is such that you really can't get reimbursed for telehealth. Which is a barrier. I mean, you can only do so much, if you will, charity work in doing that, but that's one terrific example. I think what's really going to unleash the innovation in healthcare delivery is getting the young people involved, the consumers, but especially the digital generation, because yeah. they're not used to paying for anything ever, and they're not, right? I mean, you don't know this, and they're used to getting what? Accurate answers data-driven answers. It's not all truth on their phones, but they're able to get answers immediately. There's absolutely no reason that that can't take off. We've been working on this now at Mayo for at least the last 9 years. How do we reach the rest of the world by putting answers to real problems, curated answers for patients, immediately available wherever they are? And that's where the disruption's coming. You're seeing, of course, with the various large groups coming together, most recently the Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, Berkshire Hathaway thing, to try to bring technology, logistics, capital, transparency, and new models. And that'll be driven by the young people. Folks my age want to go to the doctor, not want to go to the doctor's office, but they want to see the doctor or the nurse, right? But under whatever age it is, why would I ever go there? Why would I ever go and wait in a room full of people that are coughing and sneezing and the doctor's 2 hours late? Why would I do that? And yet try to convince my generation to change to that has been really hard. So it's going to happen, and it'll happen, I think, really fast when the power shifts just a little bit more to the consumer. Mm-hmm. And that'll be a good thing. I think that'll be, will it be perfect? No. Will we stumble around? Of course. But ultimately, there's no reason for medical knowledge and scientific breakthroughs to be mysterious to patients or unavailable. Access is everything. Mm. I think the other thing that's happened with this focus nationally on healthcare is people are starting to really care about their healthcare. Now, it's still hard to lose weight and change your diet and exercise more and all that, but at least people are thinking about it, right? And I think that the more we think about it and the more we see new innovative ways of delivering safer care at lower cost, 24/7, people wherever they live, that'll be a civilization advance. Now, places like Mayo Clinic and Mass General will still need those. The Farber will need that for patients who have diagnosed serious problems, and they need to come and get that. Sure, we can do a lot of it at home or remotely or in an outpatient setting, but great places like that where they see large volumes of really sick people who need complex diagnostic testing and treatment, that's what those places should be doing. You really want to have your heart valve done somewhere where they do 1,800 a year, right?
Yes.
You don't want to be the, I've done a few of those. I can't wait to do you. Right?
Slept in a Holiday Inn Express last night.
Do you want me to take my microphone off again?
A question you read about anywhere in the country today on consolidation, hospitals combining together with other hospital systems, and there's discussion that in the future there may be 100 large healthcare systems in the U.S. And you see these acquisitions with non-traditional players, the insurance companies and the pharmacy benefit managers, yep, like CVS and Aetna coming together. So how should patients think about when they read acquisitions like CVS and Aetna? What do you think the impact will be to patients and also to a hospital system?
Well, these are all very different approaches to the same problem of how do you provide safe, efficient care at lower cost. And so I think it's confusing to the average patient out there what's happening. But it should be exciting because there's a lot of people trying to fix the healthcare system. At Mayo, we took a different path and decided during this merger and acquisition growth in the country, we decided that wasn't going to work for us for two reasons. One, we thought if we put the Mayo Clinic name on a lot of places that weren't Mayo Clinic, then essentially Mayo Clinic disappears because people go to the Mayo Clinic expecting something. And that's why they're making that choice. And instead, what we said, our biggest impact could be how do we help other hospitals get integrated answers quickly, and so we decided to digitize our knowledge. So essentially, I'll just look at the head table here. There's a heart surgeon, a cardiologist, infectious disease, a pediatrician, a psychiatrist, they're all together, and they say, here are the problems that Mayo solves. How do we solve that? Because over here, there's a healthcare system where the neurosurgeons and the neurologists and the radiologists don't really work well together. Mm-hmm. And so we said, let's create something called Ask Mayo Expert, which is several thousand medical situations, and get Mayo to weigh in and said, so if I'm a doctor in, I'll say Middlesex Hospital in Connecticut, who just happens to be part of our system. And I can't solve this problem with recurrent kidney stones in this young person, and I've tried everything. What would Mayo do? And the pediatricians and the calcium people and the kidney doctors at Mayo have said, well, if in that situation, here are the next three things that you might consider doing. And here are the folks who wrote that. And if that's not good enough, give us a call or we'll do an e-consult, electronic consult or whatever. So we said if we took Mayo's knowledge, because we're an integrated group, and how do we work, and then use that as a product to give to other, not give, to have a subscription service to other hospitals, they could be part of what we call the Mayo Clinic Care Network. And that's turned out to be a very successful, we said, our knowledge will integrate healthcare in a group where they're not integrated. And so we're in, I think, 46 centers worldwide, 7 countries. And it's basically a subscription service. Now, we don't let anybody join that until we've done due diligence.
You didn't have to buy any hospitals.
No, we didn't have to buy any hospitals, and we don't own anybody's asbestos or anybody's malpractice or anything else like that. We basically are just saying, here's what Mayo would do in that situation, and we can do electronic tumor boards or consults or see them or whatever. And the beauty of that, Mike, is that we're now reaching, I think it's 12 million or 18 million people globally doing that. But the real beauty of it is that 80% of the people who ask Mayo for help never leave their community. They stay in their country, their town, whatever. With the help of Mayo, they don't have to travel to get that. And the 20% who do, they really do need to come. And gee, I don't think we can resect this retroperitoneal tumor. I think you should go on hospice. Well, have you asked Mayo? Well, I see that you're part of the Mayo Clinic Care Network. Sure, let's do that. Consult goes in and says, yes, we do about two of those a week. And here are our results. And so that patient then migrates to Mayo. We know all about them. And they have surgery 2 days after they arrive there. Then they go home. So instead of buying all these hospitals and just getting bigger, we said, let's stay the same size, but use our knowledge and continually refresh that. And that helps people stay at home, which is so they're innovative ways of solving these problems. That's how Mayo's done it.
Nice. So our team sent me, you recently wrote an op-ed in Wall Street Journal. That was great. Collaborating beyond organizational borders. Would you mind sharing with the audience kind of some of the themes of that?
Sure, thanks very much. So this was, we were asked to write an essay for the World Economic Forum, and I know you had Klaus Schwab here a few weeks ago. And essentially, what do you think healthcare should look like in a year or two, and no more than 600 words? I mean, that was the coolest thing in the world, to write that essay and put that together. And it was really had to be pretty focused. And we basically said the really sticky issues that face us in healthcare aren't really solved alone by healthcare. So obesity, the opioid epidemic, gun violence, violence against women, neonatal mortality, infectious disease in the subcontinent, whatever they are, they involve more than the healthcare sector. They involve transportation, they involve education, they involve energy, they involve communications. And essentially, if healthcare is going to solve these, it can't do it alone. And so it was basically a call out to the world business community to say that for these thorny issues, and I'll just take obesity and diabetes in this country, there might be a pill for it someday, there might be a vaccine for it someday, but in the meantime, this is about how do you deliver food, how do you deliver education, how do you do predictions with in populations, say, who's at risk of this? It's going to take essentially a village to do that across all sectors. And that was the theme. And it kind of harpens back to Mayo's original philosophy that you can only solve these big problems if you work together. Mm-hmm. No individual can do this. And we would argue that for the really thorny issues, it's not a single sector in society. And again, at the end, we said, these problems are solvable, but only if all of us remember there's a patient at the center of this, a patient and their family. What do they need? And then what can I contribute as an educator? What can I contribute as a nutritionist? What can I contribute if I'm redesigning cities or moving people around and so on? So that was the call out to World Economic Forum and Wall Street from Mayo. That's just how we would approach it.
Great. So we want to love to open up to questions if that's okay for you.
Be good.
We have some microphones in the room, and we have
Hi, Lori. Thanks so much.
It. But, you know, when you do studies where America stands in contrast to the 16 other most developed countries in terms of health care costs, and health care outcomes, we always end up at the bottom of that list.
We do.
And I'm curious as to what you think are the major issues. You've actually mentioned some of them, gun violence, poverty, et cetera, but, you know, how do we tackle that?
Well, it's a very terrific question from a colleague who's running the Farber. Of course, you all know her. This is a complex country, and socioeconomically, it's a complex country, and we know that. And we know, and you've seen the editorials and the science around, your zip code is almost as important as your genetic code in terms of your lifespan, right? It's where you live and what choices were made for you or you made in those formative years, whether it's education or the various paths you take in terms of discretionary decisions. I also think, and I was kind of leading up to this a little bit, that the country's awareness about how important this is has to get to a different level than it is currently. Again, I don't want to be judgmental, but this country, we haven't prioritized that as much as other countries have. So until the country decides that maternal and newborn mortality is as important as another country who prioritizes that, it won't get the attention. It won't get the investments, it won't get the innovation, all the things that need to happen. So I think it's really about the threshold of national awareness for that. And I'm not making a value judgment. I'm just making what I think is a true statement. Rural America, urban America, we can talk about the diversity in the country and the access to resources and so on and so forth. It's a different country, and we're proud of it. It's the world's greatest country. We love the country, all the rest of it. But it's a different country from Denmark or from Holland. It just is different. I'll say it's better, I'm glad I live here, but the country would have to prioritize that. Because at the moment, smaller groups with fewer resources are trying to tackle that, and we haven't made that much progress. I'd be curious in your thoughts. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I think it's really a national question that we need to ask. Thank you. Nice to see you. Thank you for your question. Others?
Doctor. Tom Sherwin over here. Hello. Okay. Thank you for coming and sharing the message of the Mayo Clinic. I understand from this morning's news that there's an opening at the VA. And if you were looking for a second career, the nation would be grateful. Perhaps you have some advice for the president in terms of who he would select to lead the VA, given the challenges of the predecessors. Mm-hmm. It seems like marvelous people have broken their reputation trying to solve that management problem. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you very much for your question. So Mayo Clinic, and I think you know Dr. Torchiana from Partners and the Cleveland Clinic, leader, and Kaiser and Johns Hopkins, we have been working behind the scenes to help the White House and Secretary Shulkin to help the VA. And again, we heard a little bit about the partisan situation or the divided state we are in our country. I can tell you that our quiet work in the background to help the VA has been met, as you would expect, with literally 100% support by my 66,000 folks. Now, they don't agree that much on anything else I do, trust me. but they are honored by Mayo's willingness to do whatever we can to help the VA. And we will continue to provide advice and counsel in the background. There are structural issues with the VA, the way it's organized, as you know. There are technology issues. And then there's a great cultural divide, and there are basically two sides to the story about privatization or retain the VA culture. And the next person to take that on, I would think, should be someone who really understands how complex it is. It's a very, very large job. I personally think a proven executive, could perhaps do it, but that hasn't proven to be so easy by taking great non-healthcare executives into that situation. I think you'd also have to know that you had a mandate to do something. I mean, Dave Shulkin had 100-0 confirmation, but there was still tremendous division, and it was a very hard situation for him to be in. I think he's a high ethical person, a wonderful person, personally, but it's a very, very tough job. But I think, again, much like the question we talked about earlier, do we have a mandate to make a change, and do we have support to make that? You all run big companies. If you have a completely divided house, it is very hard to make that change until you get the culture behind you, until you get some momentum. It's very, very, very important. There's lots of good things in the VA. There's some things that need to be fixed. But I also think you probably would get 100% of American voters to say, we're behind this. We need to make it better because we have such respect for the people who've served in our services. So it's a vexing issue. It ought to be taken, it ought to be proceeded with very, very thoughtfully and deliberately, in my opinion.
Thanks for coming and joining us. I was struck by your comments on Alzheimer's, which is if can be cured in some of our lifetimes. For those that haven't seen it, there's a real impactful piece that was on 60 Minutes this past weekend. Several of us are probably struggling with our parents or maybe even spouses. Are there any groups in particular that you think are further ahead than others on the research side or companies?
Thank you for that. Well, I don't think I can answer that because I don't think I know. There are several competing theories right now. I mean, the amyloid theory is, it just rocks solid. If you studied that literature and grew up with it, as I have over the last 20 years, you would see why that was the focus. And now the ability to prevent and remove amyloid plaques, it really works. The problem is it doesn't help the patients. They continue to deteriorate. So again, there's something missing in that. And there's a lot of support groups doing great work to help families impacted by Alzheimer's disease, but essentially the discovery neurosciences has to be supported to do that. I think if we can't get there, I don't see the answer. Again, I'm not doing research in that area, but I stay pretty close to it. I don't know where I'd put my money. But again, if you look at it in terms of the impact, I'll just say on our economy,
yep.
You've seen the numbers. By 2040, it's like 25% of our economy or something, or at least 20% of our healthcare economy is to support people who are suffering from Alzheimer's disease. You can't win in that situation. So we must do this. It's probably the biggest healthcare issue that we face. I wish I could tell you more about it.
Hi, Phyllis Yale from Bain.
Yeah.
Question about Mayo. So you talked about your 200 engineers, and in fact, when you talk to anyone who's been to Mayo, that is what they say is really distinctive, the individualized patient journeys and how you've created things. But it's not just about having 200 engineers, because you obviously need to get doctors to change, and you need to put sometimes capital to work in changing spaces. So my question to you is, how do you as a CEO create the culture, the process, right, the metrics
great
that
question.
Get that kind of
Thank
innovation?
You. Thanks so much. So I came into this role about 9 years or so ago, and the writing was clearly on the wall. The recession was in full flight. And imagine you're in Minnesota and recognize that we depend on people flying there. They have to have discretionary income, come to the Mayo Clinic. Well, there wasn't any discretionary income in 2009 and so on. And the move to reduce the cost of healthcare, reduce reimbursement, it was very clear that Mayo Clinic, even though it had been highly successful, would need to change. And so essentially, I said to the organization, we need to make some serious changes. And to be candid, I remember vividly, I was told, you're going to ruin the Mayo Clinic. Perhaps some of you have heard that as the CEO, you're going to ruin the company, whatever. It gets your attention. And I said, why? And they said, because our culture is, you know, patient-centeredness and take as much time as we need, and we can't be worried about reimbursement pressures. And I said, well, we all came here with one purpose, to help our patients. And failure as of the organization just can't even be considered. So instead of ruining the culture, we're going to use the very strong culture of Mayo, which is patient-focused, essentially service work, and working as teams to do that. And I said, I don't know what the answers are going to be, but all of you have committed to this are going to leverage that passion for the patient and come up with innovative ways of driving out healthcare costs and getting our outcomes better and re-engineering the practice. And the only stipulation I have for you is the patient can't notice it. The winning product at the end of 8 or 10 years will be everywhere else is suffering in healthcare right now, but that darn Mayo Clinic, it just keeps doing it the same old way and it's very successful. So we have to do it all behind the curtain. Make sure that the things that touch the patient, all they say to us is, you're more compassionate. You're more focused on me than ever. You're more efficient than ever. I got home earlier than you thought. You've reduced the medicines I need to take. You've given me a true answer. And so we have an enormously strong culture at the Mayo Clinic. And once they realized that that's what they were here to do, that was their purpose, they basically all started to work together, and with the management engineers, and with all the different techniques that are used to drive out waste and drive up better outcomes. You know, one rough estimate is we've completed 400 of these engineering products or projects in our practice, and have driven out $1 billion of waste in the last 5 years, just by doing that. And patients are—they're getting home earlier, they're having fewer infections. Now, there's still lots of things to do, but again, if you all know this. If you have a great culture in your company, you can do anything. And if you want them to follow your strategy, the culture has to support the strategy. And so it was basically making sure people aligned that it wasn't, we have to change. No, we don't. Why would we change? We're perfect. Well, if you don't change, you're just being stuffy. And with healthcare, you've got to change everything. And so we've managed to do that. I'm quite proud of how we've managed to do that. My successor is going to have to keep that going and maybe accelerate it with all the things we've talked about going forward. But I can tell you we've got 66,000 people who come to work with one thing in mind, and that's how do I help patients. And with that, you can really move mountains, and they've done it.
Well, final question here. Thank you so much for your service and your leadership in this industry and innovation you've brought. As you mentioned, you're highly employable in lots of places, but you've chosen to retire this year. So maybe just some parting comments on what you plan to do as part of your retirement.
Well, thanks very much. So Mayo has a tradition. The leader is always a physician from the staff. That secures the culture, if you will. So the bylaws say that my successor will be a physician paired with an administrator who's a strong business person. That's how we do it at Mayo. A person from the active staff. I can tell you that our strategy, which I've touched on a little bit, is not John Noseworthy's strategy. It's the Mayo Clinic strategy, and we have complete consensus on where we need to go. The only thing that needs to be tweaked is how far, how fast, and I think that's really the decision for the next leader. So the strategy is strong. Mayo's performing extremely well, and I've got 5 successors who I've been grooming for the last 5 years, giving them what we call enterprise-wide responsibilities, whether it's international or artificial intelligence or others. So we're hoping, we anticipate a very simple, no-drama handoff, because we're really not about the CEO, it's about the patient, and I think that'll really happen. So after retirement, my son says I'll be bored by Wednesday. He may be right, but I won't be going back to neurology to practice because I really think the more active, younger people who are focused on that will provide better care than I can. But I hope to take what I've learned in this role to continue to make a difference with other partners going forward. But I haven't. That's not all worked out yet.
Great. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Glenn. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Dr. John Noseworthy, President and CEO of Mayo Clinic. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit www.bc.edu/CEOclub.